Accession number 27315, Reel 2.
Poor Christine, they sent her these things, particularly the newspaper.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Yes, you were saying, sorry.
Right. Michael Walton, Reel 2. So, these people who'd come over from South Africa and Canada, these were volunteers, were they, or were they from their own air forces?
I can't say. Never went into it. They were a batch of pilots which would come along, and you'd be given about three or four of them, and you'd take them up in the aeroplane, and when you felt the time was right, you'd send them one at a time, send them solo. And after a bit, I was in charge of the night flying at Bybury, which is surprising considering my history. And we used to send them up at night on a flare path there.
Yeah. Tell me about your history of night flying then.
I'll tell you about somebody else's. Should I tell that story? We had one poor fellow. They said, an Oxford, you've never seen an Oxford, have you? It's sort of a great big empty thing, especially these, they've not fitted with anything. And they said, don't, when you go solo, don't look over his shoulder, it looks like a coffin. And this fellow was just about off in his solo, and we had a tyre checker. And one of the tyres was a bit flat, so this fellow opens the door and gets in. This fellow's lined up at the rim dryer, he just takes off, and he gets a tap on the shoulder. He'd taken off the tyre, man. How he got round the circuit, I don't know. Anyway, it was all very exciting in those days. And all following that, I did a course on blind landings, and we were instructing on I can't remember the name of the stuff now, I must have paid a lot of attention, at Oxford.
Right, and this was something new, was it, blind landing?
Oh, very much, yes, yes. It was a sort of a beam where you could hear dots to the left and dashes to the right, and you, of course, a dot and a dash when merged becomes a steady note, and you could come all the way down to the runway.
So what sort of equipment did you have in the plane?
Oh, a couple of radio receivers, not a lot, and some receivers which would tell you that you were sort of coming over a beacon 2 miles away and you ought to be at 600 feet, and then you come to another one and drop it down and you fly level till you got to that. And you could actually land totally blind. I've done this in thick fog at South Cerny. You come in, cross the last one, can't see a thing, ease the stick back, cut the power, and you're on the grass. Fantastic.
And that was something very new. So
that was very new, yes, yes.
Yeah. And was that available at many airfields? Or?
Well, it became available very quickly, of course. But at that time, it was very new.
Yeah.
Very new.
So, as an instructor, did you feel left out at all? You know, that you weren't operational or...
Oh, it was very nice. Read about all these other poor fellows working their shoes off. No, it was quite hard work, actually, but it was fairly straightforward. The worry is that you're not doing it yourself. I don't know what sort of a passenger you are in a car, but to send somebody solo is quite a strain on you, you know, because you think, did I overlook anything? Is he as good as I hoped he might be? And it wasn't easy, but there we are.
What about the other instructors? Were they all sort of time-served men, as it were, like yourself? Or?
A lot of them, a few of them, had operational experience. Mm. But I can't really remember. Not a great deal, I think, really.
Because it would strike me that having operational experience would be a very good thing.
Well,
to make you an efficient instructor.
I don't know, really. It meant you could fly an aeroplane.
And also you knew what it was like to be in combat, really, which is...
I don't think that ever came into it. I don't think we ever discussed that.
Right.
We just made sure that what they were doing properly then, you know.
Yeah.
And I did that for about 3.5 years.
Which takes us to where, then?
Which takes us to 1944. Mm-hmm. And they decided I'd had enough of the easy life. Mm-hmm. And... I was posted to Bomber Command.
Right.
And initially, all the training was on Halifax, just like my machine gun. You didn't know what you didn't finish up flying them, but I went on a Lancaster squadron.
And where was that?
At Hemswell in Lincolnshire.
Oh yes. And what was it like flying a Halifax after being a?
I can't remember the Halifax, but I can certainly remember the Lanc. And it was a great monster, but did everything it was supposed to do.
And
very powerful.
And were you being? I mean, you joined a squadron, did you?
Yes, I went up to Hull for the sort of initial training. There can't be many people like me who started off on Spitfires and finished up on four-engine heavy bombers, but the business in between by flying twin-engined Oxfords was a sort of stepping stone, you know, which was wonderful, really, in view of my career after the war.
Mm.
Anyway, there we are, bombers.
Was this a different culture in bomber command?
Oh, quite different, yes.
How is it different?
Well, it was quite civilised. I mean, every night you went back to a proper bed with sheets and proper breakfast, and eggs and things. And it was all very nice, but that really was, you know, you're spending very long hours in an aeroplane, 6 hours sitting there, 8 hours, all the way into the roar and things like that.
Mm. And I mean, if you were doing those long trips in the winter, I imagine it was hugely cold.
It was always freezing cold, yes.
Yeah. Even in the summer, was it?
Well, it wasn't all that bright. Well, you were flying fairly high, and the heating was not all that bright.
Mm. How did they train you for the actual bombing? I'm not an RAF person, so I don't understand. I've read a lot of Biggles. But, you know, the crew on a Lancaster, how much were you involved in the actual obviously not a bomb,
well,
aimer, wasn't it?
You had a crew. Mm. I can't remember now, 5, 7. I had a bomb aimer, myself, of course, as pilot, a navigator, a rear gunner, a mid-upper gunner, and that's 5, isn't it? And I've got a feeling there was another one somewhere, but I'm not quite sure. And I was the only one on that airplane that could fly it, which was terrible, really, when you think about it. So I made a point of training everybody on that airplane how to fly.
Really?
Well, after all, I was an instructor.
Yeah. And they literally could fly it, could it?
Well, they could get it home.
Right.
They wouldn't make much of a landing. Mm. In fact, I don't think we ever did any landings, but that didn't really matter. They'd see me do enough of them. But they could come home the right way and where the stars are and what stars to look for coming home, this sort of thing. I mean, I can find Polaris almost in the middle of the day. You get so used to it. That's the sort of thing that keeps you alive.
So, what was the main thing you had to learn going on to bombers as opposed to fighters? You know, what was the main skill? Sounds like endurance was one of them.
Oh, I suppose being able to stay awake and absolutely trust your instruments and trust your radio and get familiar with all the new radio and radar stuff which was coming in. We had a thing called H2S. Do you know about it? Do you want me to mention it? Which was a radar which would chuck a beam out in front of you, and over the sea it would just go off, so the sea would be totally black, and you come up to the coastline and it would hit the sea, hit the coast and come straight back like a radar reflector, so you could see the coastline coming up. Towns are all buildings at 90 degrees to the ground, radar reflector, so you could pick out all the towns as you went along, and those sort of things, and I used to spend quite a bit of time letting the bomb aimer fly it while I went back to the nav part and have a look at this radar. And changing the subject completely, I was very privileged the other day to go to a dinner with Professor Sir... oh, what was his name, Christine? Jodrell Bank, who...
I wasn't listening.
Jodrell Bank, what was his name?
Oh, dear, now you put me on the spot. Yes.
He's 92 and absolutely all up there.
Really?
Absolutely. I'll think of his name, how ridiculous.
Well, and
he invented all this stuff, so we had an awfully long talk about this over dinner, the two of us.
And what was the main benefit?
Bernard Lovell.
Is he still alive? I hadn't realised he was
alive. He's still alive. Yeah, I had dinner with him a year ago in the village.
Yeah. Good Lord.
It's very good, that.
Benefit of having this radar? Was it so that you could be more accurate in your navigation? Was that
the... Yes, because there was nothing else. You see, all the lights were out down the ground. You couldn't see anything. You could be miles off track, and your bombing is not very effective if you're just going to hope that you're in the right spot. And we used to go in. All the timing was done on your wristwatch. You used to sort of keep fairly accurate to this and hope that the pathfinders had got there 4 minutes before you did, which is quite a feat from here to Dusseldorf or somewhere, to light up the target for you. And then you let all the bombs go. And as you let them go, after so many seconds of flash went off, or no, the camera opened, you would see what you'd hit, so that... You know, keep an eye on it. Then you go like a bat out of hell, climbing like mad, and go home.
Yeah. So, I can imagine how hugely difficult it is to find a target, back end of Germany, as it were.
Well, I think this is why the Pathfinder Force came in, because they had a thing called OBO, which was two intersecting beams, one from UK, and I'm not quite sure where the other one came from. Norway, probably. And
that improved accuracy.
That improved accuracy for them. Mm. But they were very highly trained in the use of it. And we came up more or less right at the right time, and then you could see these coloured flares going off. Mm.
Which bomber squadrons were you in?
I just had a reunion the other day, but I didn't go. 550 squadron. You think with all my mathematics I'd remember these numbers, but I don't. Halifax, I flew a Halifax as well.
I put it all ready and I just bring it in and you have it so to go along.
Five 50 squadron.
Right. And that was based at
Hemswell.
At Hemswell, right. Do you remember any of the other chaps who were in that squadron?
Only my rear gunner, whom I got in touch with, but I've not met him. And, you know, we never used to put names down, which is a bit ridiculous, isn't it? And I don't know.
Who was the squadron leader, do you remember?
No, I couldn't tell you. There was a chap called Squadron Leader Jolly. He was with me. He was my squadron leader at one time. And then he moved to Mosquitoes, and it broke up in the air on him. And I knew his wife very well. She married again, and I went to her funeral 12 months ago. But she'd gone all gaga, which is a great shame, pity. She married again.
So what sort of role did the squadron leader play? I mean, was he the sort of father or the team leader or...?
We used to have enormous briefings. A sort of big room, like a parish hall almost, with a stage and a blackboard up there. And they'd tell you what the target was, you know, whether it was Dusseldorf or somewhere. Yes, dear?
I ask you to do the carrier.
So how detailed would that briefing be?
Quite a thorough briefing. But from what I remember, it's a long time ago, I've feeling that the navigators stayed behind afterwards and pored over maps more so than we.
What was the most difficult target you had to find?
Not really the right question there. I think because we were navigated there with all the aids that the navigator could come up with. I was more or less flying the aeroplane and making sure we didn't get into trouble. And, you know, keeping a lookout. But after many hours, there it was, you know, and you came up on it and ran through it. Some targets were easier than others, not necessarily to find, but to deal with and get away from. I mean, if it was Wilhelmshaven or something like that, sort of a port, you could drop your bombs and more or less go home, providing you dodge the flak. Whereas one or two of them, you were going up the Ruhr Valley, and that was hell. But
did you have a lot of good information about the anti-aircraft batteries?
Oh, yes, which was rather like saying, this water is very cold. You know, you've got to get in it anyway. So it was not a lot you could do about it. But they were very good. In fact, you could, to a certain extent, navigate by the flak.
I mean, what were the longest raids you went on? I mean, did you go on any of these 1,000 bomber raids?
I've done 1,000 bomber raids, and I've also done one of these enormous American raids when they had the Air Force join the B-52s going over Germany in daylight. Really? And that was a sight to see. I mean, you know, an air display is a piddly little thing, really.
So where did you take off for that one, then?
Oh, it was the same, from Lincolnshire.
Right.
But we used to sort of take off and circle and climb and circle and climb and head out to the coast. And then you'd say, well, this is the other lot over there, and join up. And it got more and more like Piccadilly Circus, except at night when, of course, all this was happening and you couldn't see anything, which was a bit frightening because you're not quite sure who you were alongside. I told you earlier on that they let a camera go off when you dropped your bombs, and I've got a lovely photograph of a Lancaster right underneath me. And whether the bombs had gone through his wings or not, well, they probably missed him, but, I mean, it was very crowded over these target areas, very crowded indeed.
I mean, did they ever have any crashes?
Oh, yes, a lot, yes.
And what could you do to avoid crashing into somebody or vice versa?
Well, you had to keep a very good lookout, but you were doing a lot of weaving about. I mean, you used to treat the Lank as a Spitfire after a bit because you couldn't break that aeroplane. It was, you know, you could pull it about and do steep turns, anything like that. And the more you made the crew sick, the happier they were. But again, I'm very lucky. All my life, I have flown the best in aeroplanes. And from the Spitfire was magnificent, the Lank was magnificent, and all the aeroplanes civil use, like the Comet and the VC-10 and anything, they're all beautiful aeroplanes. And we do know how to build aeroplanes.
Mm-hmm. So the 1,000 bomber raid, where was that?
Oh, up in the Ruhr somewhere. Without going through the logbook, and I won't open it and bore you to tears with that, but in fact, I doubt if I've got them written down. I'd have the trip, you know, would just say Dusseldorf, 6.5 hours, and that's about the lot, a one-liner, but the fact that you've got half the American Air Force with you doesn't show up anywhere.
What was your opinion of the American Air Force at the time?
Well, very thorough. Very thorough. Mm. Very steady people.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. If you've got all the B-52s and all the Lancasters...
But all coming from different fields, you see. The only thing is we all finish... The only time you really get to know them for a very short while was coming back. Has anybody ever mentioned the word Fido to you?
No.
Because very often, if you were on a 6 or 8 hour trip, the weather could change considerably and you'd come back to a totally fogged out UK. And at a place called Cardington, I think I've got the name right, they dug a trench either side of the runway and filled it with petrol. And they used to light this, and you could see that through the thickest fog you've ever seen in your life. You'd sort of literally approach hell, you know, and land on the runway. And if it was a bad raid and a lot of people were damaged and knocked up or it was very foggy, you'd get everybody into Cardington. An enormously long runway. And, you know, you might be landing behind a Lank or two B-52s or somebody who totally got lost, you know. So you would then meet up in the mess and say, what were you doing? And have a chat with the Americans then.
So you had a sort of debrief in the mess, did you?
There was always a quick debriefing and then you go and have breakfast.
And that was yours, the personal debriefing? You'd chat to other people, would you?
Afterwards you talk to other people in the mess, but the debriefing was just the crew.
Yeah.
With the intelligence officer.
At what stage did you know about D-Day? Did you hear about this before?
I was on leave at D-Day, funnily enough, because don't forget I'd done one tour and I was now on Lanks and things had quietened down a bit. And what happened on D-Day? I can't remember. I know I was home, so I wasn't involved at D-Day.
Did you hear about it beforehand? Were you aware it was going to happen?
Oh, no, no.
Yeah, amazing. And after D-Day, then, you were...
What date was D-Day?
D-Day was early June 44.
6th of June. Oh, yeah, still operational then. Mm. It was just that on that particular moment, I was having a break.
You weren't involved in it.
Lucky again.
Yeah.
Lucky again. Although the fighter people were more into that, weren't they? But by that time it was, what, typhoons and Spitfire gone to Malta, hadn't they?
Yes.
Or gone off somewhere.
That's it. So your war continued, bombing Germany, was it, basically?
Basically bombing Germany, yes.
Mm. What did you see of the... bombings of Hanover and Hamburg and
Freiburg, you bombed several times.
Two things I'll give you, and only two things. I was on a raid to somewhere, I can't remember, and we came back via Dresden. And it was just like a coal fire that had gone out, you know. It was absolute murder down there. They'd set the whole place on fire. And I saw that from about 15,000 feet. But I wasn't on that raid. Mm. We went past it. I think, in fact, we were sent out to draw the fighters off. Or, you know, we were bombing something which seemed quite useless at the time. Yeah. And we came back past the
regiment. No.
And the other thing which really sort of put me off the whole business was that we'd... Freiburg is a town near the junction of the Italian borders down Europe that way, and officially a railhead, you know.
Well, the marshalling yard.
A marshalling yard, yes. But they sent, I don't know, 800 bombers, 600 bombers, I think, loaded with nothing but incendiaries. The aiming point was the cathedral, and the time was Sunday at 6 o'clock. And you couldn't have got out of that town in a fast car, you know. We didn't have a single loss. There wasn't a single anti-aircraft fire. So, you know, not proud of that one.
Because there was quite a lot of sort of bad feeling about former command.
Well, of course, poor old Harris... Butch Harris, as he was known. They always call him Bomber Harris. He was never known as Bomber Harris. He was always Butch Harris. Butcher Harris. admittedly, we had an enormous amount of losses, but we did an enormous amount of damage. And it's really for historians to work out, and it's too close now, as to whether, you know, whether it was all worth it or not. That's what it was, really.
Did you feel the criticism at the time, or being in bombing?
No, it wasn't at the time, no. This all came after the war. When they left all the honours off him and everybody else got it, you know, and excuse me, all the fighter command brass hats were honoured and everything like that.
And you got the DFC, what did you get that for?
My stock answer is being first in the NAFI. No, I think it was one of those things. You know, I can't pin it down to anything particular, but I think if you've done two tours successfully and without blotting your copybook and have been reasonably successful in everything you've done.
So, as the war was coming towards an end, did you know it was going to end? Did you get this sense that...
Yes. The war had finished when I left the RAF, because at that time, and we're now coming full circle, of course, Imperial Airways had ceased to exist years ago, but British Airways, which was British Overseas, BOAC in those days, were starting up and looking for pilots. And I thought, that's me. Mm-hmm. And so I applied to them.
While you were still in the
while Army. I was still in the Air Force. Yeah.
Was this before the end of the war? Or
1945.
Right.
And I think the War of Japan was still on. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm not one for dates. I'd have to look it up. Mm-hmm. Are you want to run out of that tape?
Yeah, in a moment, yeah.
So I applied for BOAC, and I was very lucky because two things. One, that the only aeroplanes they had for the overseas flights, you know, the Australia and the Tokyo and all that, were, believe it or not, Lancaster bombers called Lancastrians that they put seats in. So once again, we didn't have to learn how to fly the aeroplane, and I went in as a captain.
Right.
And I was very lucky, because 6 months later, people who joined as first officers, well, 12 years later, they were still first officers. You know, we just took the bulge with ex-bomber pilots.
Right. Okay, I'll stop you just there. Michael Moulton, end of reel 2.